Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Sonny.
Do you know a guy named John Beer?
I do know a man named John Beer.
Where'd you meet him?
I met him in Portland, Oregon in 2013, but prior to that, I'd read his book, The Wasteland, in probably 2011.
Was it a house party that you met him?
Who? It might have been. Did I tell you in a past life that it was a house party that I met a man?
No, I just, so this is one of the things that I've always admired about John is he is what I would consider an established poet. He's got a really secure, great teaching,
Tenured.
tenured career teaching gig. And usually folks in his position, you don't see at readings or house parties unless they're the featured author. And I feel like I can't go to a reading, no matter who's reading, or a house party that's like mostly like a writing kind of crowd without him being there. And I really admire that he just shows up.
Well, I mean, he's a social butterfly. And I mean, he does it. I mean, I don't know if he goes to everything, but I think he's invested in the literary community in Portland. And I mean, also, as you talk, he was a theater critic. I mean, he's in, let's just say, the artistic community in Portland.
So I should say this is maybe the first one we did, the first interview where you tried where both of us were not in the room. How did that work for you?
I wasn't there, so it worked great.
Okay.
How did it work for you?
I think it works good. It definitely was different. It made me, I do find that I tend to be giggly when you are here. So I feel like I got serious. I hope it's for the
You
best.
came with the hard-hitting, serious questions for John Beer, eh?
Well, I don't know. But he's super nice and really easy to talk to.
He's also really good at pub trivia, which is the only thing that matters in life. So
Oh.
We play at the basement pub at 9 o'clock every Sunday, and he is the bulwark. Him and Ed Skoog are the bulwark of that team.
I believe that.
Well, it's good because it's true.
Welcome to the steer. Is that good? Is that
Yeah,
a good
that's good.
intro?
That's really kind of like,
A good intonation?
well, I don't mean on the air, but I just mean in general because, well, whatever. Yeah, let's do this.
Can you just talk a little so I can hear your voice?
Okay, I'll just talk away so that you can hear the levels. That seem like a reasonable volume and such.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Okay, good.
John. Welcome.
Yes.
Welcome to the studio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonny.
Where can we start? One thing that I know about you that I find really interesting is you worked for, I don't know how many years, but a number of years as a theater critic in Chicago.
Yeah, that's correct. About 9 years total as a freelancer, and then for a couple of years as a staff writer on Time Out Chicago. And I also worked in New York as a freelancer for, among other places, the sadly departed Village Voice,
Oh no.
which at the time I worked there was in the process of becoming sadly departed. It was getting thinner and thinner, which was. It was too bad. It was kind of, felt like a sort of teenage dream in a way to be working at the Village or to be writing for the Village Voice, and then and there were still amazing people working there, but it was definitely on kind of a death spiral.
What years were those?
2006 to 2008.
Oh yeah, I can imagine already at that time you feel it.
Yeah, I mean, and that was a point at which a lot of the alternative weeklies were starting to go under. I think the Chicago Reader, which I never wrote for, but was definitely a big part of my life in Chicago, had gone from being, probably a couple of hundred pages every week to 30 or 40. Yeah.
Did you? I'm curious how you ended up in that world. Were you interested originally in theater in other ways?
Well, it's true that I have been, I think since high school, had dramatic interests, but and when I was in college, I wrote a bit about theater, but I really sort of fell into it when I was in Chicago in my late 20s. At one point, this was, I was trying to get my career as a writer off the ground, and I, you know, and I was, you know, I had all sorts of different strategies. And one thing I thought was that it was time for me to start writing book reviews. That would be, and I did write some book reviews for the Tribune, but I had a good friend, actually. Some listeners may know of Kate Zambrano, who herself has since gone on to an illustrious literary career. But she, at that time, was the editor of a really little but great alternative weekly called New City in Chicago. Mm. And so I asked her if she was interested, if she needed any book reviewers, and she said no, but that they really did need some drama critics. And she thought I could do that. And so I started there, and I think getting paid $10 a review or something like that.
Yeah.
But free tickets too. And then after I'd done that for a couple of years, the editor of Time Out Chicago, their theater section, got in touch with me and asked me if I wanted to start writing for them. And then ultimately I came out to the staff there too.
That must have been really encouraging.
Yeah, it was exciting. Yeah.
When you wanted to review books, was poetry books then, or were you
not
more
necessarily
into fiction?
Yeah, not necessarily. I do enjoy writing poetry reviews, and I think there's I think poetry criticism is a really important and undervalued aspect of literary culture, but I also didn't necessarily envision that there'd be a huge market for that. So, you know, for the Tribune, I wrote about some poetry, but I also remember there was a book about Nabokov and butterflies, for instance.
Right.
So that kind of thing.
Yeah.
For the general reader.
Yeah, I can totally imagine that, or totally understand that you would say poetry criticism is wildly underrated, because I have the impression any kind of art form that isn't largely in the public view, a great way to get people to think about it is to have critics say, this is what I thought,
mm-hmm.
and sort of encourage them to check it out and see if they agree or not.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I think it's also, and this might be a little self-serving as a former critic, but I do think that act of response is kind of, it's not just a about building awareness, although that's a part of it, but also about being able to check your responses with others and to really sort of think publicly about what a work is doing. And this isn't necessarily a direction I could talk about this at mm-hmm. at horrifying length, but I do think that there's something really you know, telling and dreadful about, you know, this may seem next to a lot of what's going on in this country and in the world right now, but I think it's actually kind of sort of symptomatic, things like the decline of the alternative weeklies, which I, you know, as a teenager, I remember really helping to shape my sense of what cultural possibilities were out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think obviously people are finding their ways to other things now too, but something about that, the loss of that cultural space and public space seems to me like actually, you know, really tragic. So.
Yeah, what I found so great about all those weekly papers, it was such a low entry level that it wasn't hard to get in, and once you were, you're surrounded by a lot of maybe people at your level, but a lot of sort of legends, and you can look up and think, I could get there if
yeah.
I work hard enough and long enough.
That's right, yeah.
And in big papers, that's not so easy, I don't
right.
think.
Well, and I think, yeah, and there's a whole different set of concerns driving what gets covered and mm-hmm. how it gets covered and things like that. So, yeah, the articulation of a sort of consciously alternative or oppositional point of view again, it just seems like it was a really great thing to have had. And it, you know, obviously, that's there on, you know, Twitter or something now. But it's a very different setup, I think.
Are there any poetry critics that you would recommend?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yes. You know, Stephanie Burt is someone who I always read with pleasure, and she has a remarkable capacity for responding to different sorts of work. So I would definitely name her, and accessible.
Where does she write?
Lots of different places. I think, you know, the Times will occasionally publish her. Michael Robbins, who is someone I knew in Chicago, is cantankerous, and in some ways, actually, I could imagine would have had a place in the 70s era Village Voice if they were really into poetry criticism.
Right.
And I, you know, I disagree with probably 80% of what he writes, but he's a really interesting voice, and he's someone that you can find in the Chicago Tribune, online pretty often.
But I find it so fun, even if I really disagree with them.
Oh, totally. Yeah,
it's still art. Like, you're not. There's nothing dangerous about it. It's
kind of
fun.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, should we go into? So you gave us a really great list of music.
Thank you. And I should say these are records that I've records. I'm dating myself, but. Not necessarily things I know totally deeply, but that I've been really into in the last 6 months to a year. I should say that some of this came out of I just got back from a year in Berlin, and a group of these, and maybe we'll talk about this more explicitly in a bit, but some of this is sort of discovery from that, and so yeah. Anyway.
No, that's actually exactly what I wanted to ask. Where did you find this stuff? So was it just people in Berlin telling you, listen to this?
You know, it was not so much word of mouth as it was kind of trawling the internet, I guess. Okay. Yeah, despite whatever I was just saying. Several of the artists are people that are based in Berlin. Although, yeah, but I never saw them while I was there. Mm-hmm. I missed, I guess, one big concert in the fall because I hadn't yet copped onto some of these records. But I gather there's sort of a scene coming out of Stockholm. They're like the Stockholm Conservatory. So these are people that generally have like pretty heavy classical training, but are also venturing into where that sort of meets contemporary electronica and such. And a lot of them have then moved on to Berlin, which is, you know, as I'm sure you know, is a big center for both classical music and electronic music. So
yeah, kind of all the arts seem to have been really blossoming there for a while.
It's true. It is kind of it has its issues too, but it was really pretty nice to be in that environment for a while.
Can I just ask one more thing because you got me curious? What were you doing in Berlin?
Well, I, you know, ordinarily I have a day job teaching at a very consuming and wonderful day job teaching at Portland State University. And I had a year off from that. I had a sabbatical year. So I wanted to get out of town, and I'd always wanted to spend more time in Berlin. And it seemed like a place that is reasonably expensive, you know, reasonably priced enough that I could live there without too much of a hassle, and exciting. So I seized the opportunity.
Did you have friends there already?
I did. I mean, not tons, but mostly American expats. Mm-hmm. And got to know some people while I was there as well.
Yeah, that's kind of all you need. If you've got a year, you just need a few people to help get you moving to meet
exactly.
other people.
Yeah.
Berlin, I was only there for a couple of days once, and I could really tell that it was happening, but I could tell I need more friends here because I can't figure this city out. Well, with that, I'm going to play one of the things you shared. I hope I pronounced this right. Caterina Barbieri?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Okay. This is from an album called Patterns of Consciousness. It reminds me a lot of Steve Reich and just the minimalists, that it, the way it kind of builds on itself and keeps going.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Reich and Terry Riley and maybe especially Lamont Young are reference points for a lot of these younger musicians. And also in Caterina Barbieri's case, I read an interview where she is obsessed with Baroque era lute music.
Okay.
So she's kind of putting those together into this concept. And you know, I think that that the idea of the Baroque fugue, and its sort of unfolding repetition, has a kind of kindred spirit in a way to the to people like Steve Reich.
Do you does she employ the same kind of counterpoint that you find in Baroque? You know.
I don't think so, but it tends to be more more
additive.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah, it's not it's not counterpointed in that way. But yeah, it has that sort of hypnotic trancey sense to it.
Yeah, I could feel it the moment it started. I could kind of feel myself just like, oh, I could be driving for a long time with this. And it's kind of, I mean, it's part of the format, but it makes me, I hate that I then start talking in the middle of it because it's killing what it's doing. But I mean, that's just what we have to do.
Yeah, it's true. And I forget if you said, but that's called, the album is called Patterns of Consciousness, which seems like right. As far, and I like the way it's got the, you know, on the one hand there's a sort of psychedelic sound to it, but also I think but also like sort of quasi scientific, and there is a sort of that almost scientific sense of systematic exploration at work as well.
Yeah, it definitely has a surgical precision.
Yeah.
Let me play another one. This is from an I also call it albums because I don't know what else to say, but from an album called For Organ and Brass by Ellen Arkbro.
Thank you.
What I like so much about this, sorry to be so drying with my voice coming in, but she very slowly adds these extra layers that are subtle. Like you start to hear harmonics, a little high stuff. And right before I started talking, there was a low note that really rounded it out. And for me, it has that effect where I'm listening much more carefully. Like, yeah. Oh, what's coming?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think when I said earlier, Lamont Young is kind of a reference point. I think the idea of microtones is also like very much at play here. And, you know, pitches that go off the traditional scale. And that kind of dissonance that you're hearing there, and in both cases, I think it really does alter your sense of time.
Yeah,
and the temporality of these of this music is kind of what pulls me in, a big part of it.
And do you know, is it real organ and real brass?
Yes.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. In fact, it was recorded. I forget where exactly, but she found this, 300-year-old church organ in some town cathedral.
In Sweden?
In Germany. Yeah. Yeah. And recorded it with the brass players in there. So you also have this sense of, so there's time and then there's space too, right? Because it is this kind of cavernous setting, and I think it comes through on the recording.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that I find. I love to see and hear that live.
Yeah,
sort of every now and then see the trombone like release his spit valve or whatever.
No kidding. Yeah.
How do you remember how you found it? Was it just tooling around online, or did you hear?
Yeah,
that?
I think it may have been some kind of. In fact, I'm sure it was, because I as I often do, I think in January was sort of going through various best of the year lists, and someone, I forget who, had this record on, had the Arc Bro as one of their best of the years. And so I checked it out. And then that led me to the Barbieri, the Patterns of Consciousness,
cool,
because they are label mates.
Oh,
and in
right.
fact, there's a little label in Berlin, and the name is something like Spectrum. I don't think it's exactly Spectrum, but yeah, you might be able to look it up.
I don't see it. Well, we'll put links to all of their these things on.
But anyway, that that was what sort of gave me the sense too of this real tight community. Mm-hmm.
Do you listen to? We're not talking at all about your poetry, but do you listen to any of this stuff while you write?
Sometimes. I would say more when I'm reading or when I'm writing prose. With poetry, I tend to not want that, just because of trying to attend to the musicality of the language itself. But but having said that, I think it's almost certainly the case that I have written stuff listening to this too.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that you listen to it when you're reading. Doesn't that, because it creates kind of a soundtrack, but does it not mess with it if you're reading something, I don't know, really sad, and the music suddenly gets really happy? Are you like...
Yeah. I guess, yeah. I mean, if you know, maybe I'm reading something more like
journalism.
So academic.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's pull up another one. This is All My Circles Run by Sarah DeVacci. I hope I said that right.
Thank you.
I'm curious, do you know how many voices are actually being used?
That's a really good question. I have no idea.
I was looking at the liner notes because I could totally imagine that she brought in a full choir, but it looks like it's just her and another woman.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to tell if it's the track is called For Voice, so I would guess it's only voice.
Yeah.
But for a moment I thought I heard string, but the way it's all blended together, it's not the point, obviously, to try and pick it apart the way I am. But I love the way it kind of slides into this dissonance and then slides out.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 And again, I think Devachi, and I'm also not sure 100% of the pronunciation, but she is American, but also found her way to Stockholm and into this fold of minimalist European women composers also, which I think one of the things that I find exciting and interesting about this is that it seems to be a scene kind of at least featuring several really strong women composers, which is not the case with like 60s minimalism in the States. For the most part, there certainly are figures.
Most composers in general for forever, I think.
No, it's true. And yeah, that was something that it really came out. I would go to the Philharmonic as often as I could, actually. So, probably twice a month I was going to the Berlin Philharmonic, which is amazing.
Wow.
But yeah, so it's always going to be a white guy on the podium.
Yeah. It's very so uncomfortable.
Yeah. And actually one thing I was thinking just as you were playing that was how, to come back to this idea of time too, the way in which in all three of these that we've listened to so far, for me, there's also there's the temporality of the music itself, and there's also the kind of historical time that's going on, because they really do seem, to me at least, at one and the same time, like very contemporary, but also like potentially medieval or Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
That Devachi piece in particular, and which reminded me that I think some would argue the first European composer in the sense that we think of composers was a woman,
Hildegard.
Mystic. Yes, Hildegard of Bingen.
Yeah.
And that kind of trancy mysticism of these records too is part of what appeals to me. I don't know whether they would appreciate that characterization, but it does seem like there's some sign that there's a kind of spiritual energy to this work as well.
And I can actually, having heard what you said earlier, I can actually totally appreciate why you put this on when you want to read just about anything, because so many of us, I'll just speak for myself, but I assume most people are constantly trying to not get addicted to everything on the internet,
mm-hmm.
and not having to go back and say, oh, what's new? And if I want to sit down and read something on paper without having that feeling, putting an album on this can kind of help ground me to just this moment and just this place.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's the effect I get too, for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah. Let's see. The next thing you shared, I hope I understood this right. It's written by Randy Gibson, but performed by Andrew Lee.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And this, you might want to skip ahead a bit because
I don't know
if that's possible.
Me. Oh yeah, it is. Okay, I'll skip a little bit. How, like 5 minutes?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right.
It's a little slow at the start.
Yeah. When I first heard it, I gotta start coming in softer with my voice. Sorry.
It's okay.
When I first heard it, it reminded me immediately of Morty Feldman. Mm-hmm. Do you know his?
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea if Randy Gibson is influenced by him, but it has that same space. And I don't know if I skipped ahead to where what mm-hmm. you meant.
Yeah.
But. It does what the other pieces were doing, where it stretches your time, but then it does it with, well, to repeat the word, with space between these single notes.
Yeah, and Feldman is makes sense as a reference point too because of the scale of it, and this piece is really hard to do in this context because. It's like a 4 hour long, and that's just one little bit of it. 4 hours of, and in some cases much more intricate and much less spacious or spare,
mm-hmm.
Variations on the D keys on the piano, right? so it's called the Four Pillars.
Four pillars appearing from the equal D under resonating apparitions of the eternal process in the midwinter star field 16, 8, 10.
Yeah, so there you go. And that is it. And it is the resonating Ds, which in that bit you didn't hear so much. But as it goes on, especially in some of the busier pieces, busier moments, the overtones and these kind mm-hmm. of phantom pitches really become super pronounced, and that is one of the things that's the sort of virtual piece above the piece almost is really pretty pretty engaging to me.
Do you tend to listen with headphones or speakers?
Headphones.
Yeah, I can imagine. I always feel like I hear more. Yeah. Maybe I just haven't invested in proper speakers.
Possibly, but no, it is, yeah, I think much easier to hear that sort of thing.
Do you know if it's a prepared piano?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Yeah, but I don't know for sure,
Sure, sure.
And I should say, the guy that's performing it, this Andrew Lee, mm-hmm. is someone who I've, I guess I've become a fan of.
Oh.
And he's done a whole series, and there's a label which seems like it may be pretty much just devoted to him, uh-huh. called Irritable Hedgehog, and he specializes in sort of contemporary, often minimalist based or minimalist inspired piano pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And everything I've heard of his, and I think there's a dozen or so albums that they have put out, and everything I've listened to, I've really liked. So,
performers like that, I would be so eager to be able to see their practice routine, because he must spend so much time just working on the slightest touch.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's going to be so many subtle differences in between, you know, piano and pianissimo or whatever.
Yeah, and it's also just, I think, really kind of inspiring in a way. And I'm not sure of this, but from a photo I've seen, he looks to be in his maybe early 30s. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like he decided fairly early on that this is what he's going to do. Like, yeah. And just to go for it and to be one of the premier people working in a very tiny field. Come back. And in the same way that it would be, I would really admire anyone that just went out to devote themselves to poetry criticism.
Yeah.
The sort of I marginal practices that I find intensely valuable. So
let's go to another one. This is Simple Lines of Inquiry is the album, and it's by Yves Egoyan.
Egoyan.
Thank you, Egoyan.
And the composer is Anne Southam.
Oh, what?
Egoyan's the pianist.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Now I see it on the cover. I think when it first started, I had a reaction that probably most people wouldn't, which is I kind of relaxed, like, oh, because there was a time when I was trying to listen to tons, and I don't know if this qualifies, but I was trying to listen to tons of serialist and 12-tone music, mm-hmm. trying to get into it. And so because of spending so much time with that, it's like, oh, this familiar thing.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Alban Berg and mm-hmm. things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. She is, Anne Southam was a totally different generation from everything else we've been listening to so far. I believe born in the 30s,
oh, wow.
And she died fairly recently. Mm-hmm. Canadian composer. Mm-hmm. And and working in that kind of classic modernist vein. Mm-hmm. I think someone like Berg seems right. There's something about the stillness of it that I find really appealing, and I think, you know, she had a real love, I think, of like the Canadian prairie and like the empty spaces. Mm-hmm. And and that sense of space comes through again, I think, in a different way, maybe almost less programmatic way than in the Randy Gibson.
Hmm. She seems like an example of how my music studies were really lacking, and they weren't working hard enough to find the women.
That's right. No, and I think she talked. I saw at least one interview where, you know, she was quite open about facing a lot of horrific institutional sex throughout her career, and I think probably never got quite the recognition that she maybe could have. Although it seems like in the last decade, probably toward the end of her life and afterwards, increasingly that there is some attention being paid, as much attention as gets paid to any serialist composer for piano. But and just to sort of trace through again, and I came to her through that Andrew Lee, who has also recorded some of her music, and then the pianist there, Eva Goyen. I think it's kind of just interesting to me. She is the sister of Adam Egoyan, who is a film director.
Okay.
And one of my back when I was in my 20s and early 30s, I still like him, but I really super excited about this guy. So
what films did he make? Just a couple.
He was probably the best known. He made the movie with Ian Holm is the school bus driver, and there's a bus accident that kills a bunch of children and sort of devastates this town. It's based on a Russell Banks novel.
Wow.
He made a movie called The Adjuster, about it, and it just crazy movie about an insurance adjuster. and then early on, he made these films that were sort of formally about blending film and video. Hmm. That were really innovative. And so that to find out that, you know, his sister is also this incredibly accomplished artist in a different realm, because she again, I think along with Andrew Lee, is like one of the premier people for performing contemporary avant-garde piano.
Do you feel any similarities between the kind of music that Eve plays and the kind of films that her brother makes?
It's a good question. I think there's something uncompromising in both cases. Mm-hmm. And his films also, I think there's a sort of jagged emotionality to them. Like, they're very powerful. The kinds of movies that they could have a very powerful effect, and it might be hard to articulate exactly why. Mm-hmm. And so I think something about enigma and powerful feeling working together. I think that seems like, I'm curious what the household was like when they were growing up.
I always just find it really interesting, not only to trace the lineage of who influenced who and go back and back, but also who are their siblings or who did they grow up with.
Yeah.
And if they all ended up making certain kinds of art, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, well, and I think they both grew up in Toronto, and I feel like there's something, I like Cronenberg, feels like in the constellation there somehow too. That sort of, like that wonderful Toronto chill.
Good, yeah. So to change it up a little, you shared something. It's from an album called Black Origami, and the artist is Jalen.
Jalen.
Jalen, okay.
Yeah.
Are you listening to that when you're reading?
Maybe not so much. Yeah.
It's really fun. It kind of just makes me happy and makes me want to move.
Yeah.
When would you say you're listening to that? Driving?
Maybe driving, but maybe just at home too.
Cleaning the house.
Cleaning the house, or you know, I'll sometimes just sit and listen to things too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially, I find that. What I really like about Black Origami is the kind of like sonicscapes that's building and the sense and which and this this feels as though there's a direct relationship to what I'm thinking about as far as my own writing and all of this actually pieces in one way or another, the idea of a sort of world construction, mm-hmm. And part of it has to do with almost like the quasi algorithmic. You think there's that bit in there that I was thinking back to the patterns of consciousness, the Barbieri with you know the repeated sort of figure that she had in there.
Yeah.
But then there's, you know, it's much more, collagey as well. And from one minute to the next, you know, it's almost as though, anything can happen, but it's coherent.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me, I think, you know, sums up something of what I'm trying to do in what I put on the page, so to speak. So
I like that. I like the thought that even though you're not listening to the music while writing, it might affect it more that you listen to it while not writing so that you can absorb it. And then when the moment comes, then it sort of comes out.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Hmm. One more. So this is Tahoe. Let's see. So the group is Dedekin?
Dedekin Cut.
Thank you.
Yeah, Dedekin Cut, and the record is Tahoe.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that was it cut out because it's on Google Play and we haven't bought it. The song doesn't actually cut out that way. I didn't realize. That was just so soothing. That was a warm bath.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where did you, was that something you also found in Berlin?
No, actually, that's something I came across just in the last month or so. It's pretty new. And honestly, I forget exactly how. Although, again, I feel like whatever anti-internet animus I was bubbling up at the beginning of this, I have to take back now, because and it is amazing, you know, how much stuff is available now in a way that it you know, I mean, to track down any of this music, 20 years ago would have been a real challenge, and in some ways, you know, that was nice, but it's also nice to hear about stuff. And yeah, Dedekin Cut is a guy by the name of Lee Bannon, which is actually, I think that's not his birth name, but that's what he was what he goes by, and working in a sort of ambient tradition, but African American musician, and I think sort of consciously pushing against the sense that's a fairly white dominated scene.
Yeah, it's great. It's interesting. I'm guessing we didn't hear something representative of the whole album because it says it's dance electronic.
See, that's interesting. That piece is pretty representative, and I think that categorization may have something to do with the perception that a more ambient record is a record that some white guy made.
Oh, okay. Well, it's great. Yeah, I really appreciate you coming. I just so enjoy talking to people about things that aren't necessarily their, in your case, your expertise is poetry, and I think philosophy, and maybe you'd still say theater?
To some degree.
But it's so nice to hear you talk about something that you, more than enjoy, you get a lot of pleasure about.
It's definitely something that's... I spend a lot of time not just listening, but tracking down things. So, I have to say, like it has. One reason I sort of put this bundle together, and maybe particularly the first three, gave me this sense that I feel like I haven't had in a long time of sort of coming across something, and. Feel like there's all these layers to the scene, like the way that this is embarrassing in a way, but when I was 17 and finding out Husker Du and The Replacements are both from Minneapolis and wow, what's going on, and Prince is there too, like what's going on in Minneapolis,
what's in the water.
Yeah, so
when did you get back from Berlin?
Like 3 months ago.
Okay. Has it been hard to get back, or do you feel like, oh, good, back home?
It's lovely to be back in Portland. I like living here a lot, but I definitely, there are things about the Berlin experience that were terrific, and, it is easier to speak English all the time. So there is that. Yeah.
How's your German?
Nicht so schlecht.
Yeah. Not so bad.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming. It was really nice talking to you.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to The Steer, recorded at KBOO Radio, broadcast on dublab.com, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Sonny Bleckinger. For more, see our website at www.the-steer.com. You can download our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, and anywhere podcasts are found.